welcome to the Theology Mill podcast, brought to you by Wipfenstock Publishers. My name is Zach Mickle. I am the Digital Marketing Manager and Associate Acquisitions Editor here at Wipfenstock, and I'm also the host of this podcast, which consists of interviews with leading authors and thinkers in theology, biblical studies, and philosophy. If you like what you're hearing on the podcast, please stop by our website at wipfenstock.com, where you can browse our catalog and also read our blog. So on this episode, I got to speak with Dr. Amy Patterson, and Dr. Patterson is a Christian ethicist at the Salvation Army Ethics Center and an adjunct faculty at Booth University College in Winnipeg. She is the author of the new Cascade book, Suffering Well and Suffering With, Reclaiming Marks of Christian Identity, which was published within the New Studies in Theology and Trauma series. So without any further ado, let's hop over to the interview. And as always, thanks very much for listening. Okay, so I am here with Dr. Amy Patterson, who is the author of Suffering Well and Suffering With, Reclaiming Marks of Christian Identity, which just published with us at Cascade in the last few months. Before we get started, Amy, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, and then maybe how you kind of came to study suffering, particularly as it relates to Christian religion today?
Well, thanks, Zach. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm very gratified to be invited. So, a little bit about me. I grew up as a pastor's kid in the Salvation Army. So, we moved place to place, but I've lived in Winnipeg for about 13 years. I don't know if you or listeners will know where Winnipeg is. I'm a proud Canadian, and Winnipeg is kind of dead center in North America, if you look at the whole continent. And so I guess I would consider Winnipeg home. And I did my undergrad degree here, and then I moved away with my husband to Montreal, which is another favorite place of mine to live. We did a stint in Nova Scotia, and then we came back here. So I've been here for about 13 years now. And it's just a nice place to be. We were just named the third best city to live in Canada. So We're pretty proud of that. Anyway, about sort of how I came to study suffering. I did my graduate work at McGill in Montreal, and I studied religious ethics with a focus on bioethics, and my dissertation was on ethics at the end of life. So at the time, I was really interested in the interplay of healing and technology, and I still am. But the real reason I studied ethics in particular is because it was pretty clear from the beginning that I didn't want to function exclusively in academic circles. I am an adjunct faculty member at Booth University College, which is my Winnipeg alma mater. But my primary role is as Christian ethicist for the Salvation Army Ethics Center. And it's here that I get to bring together academic scholarship and the people who want to learn how to best follow Christ. And you know, ethics is classically deemed practical philosophy. So it's the obvious way to bring these two circles together. My research interests are broad because I have to have that broadness to do the job I do. But I am particularly interested in suffering. And this is for two reasons. One is you know, my own academic specialty. I focused on dying people, suffering people. So I've learned a lot about end-of-life care from my studies. And, well, I suppose I could bring up that old-fashioned line, experience is the best teacher, because despite my academic suffering, it was personal, academic interest in suffering, it was personal suffering that got me attuned to what it means for a Christian person to suffer well, to think about what the virtue of compassion looks like in day-to-day life, and why Christians are called to build and maintain communities of compassion. So I write about my personal suffering in my book. And that's the attitude I have when I approach people. I wanted to make it accessible to anyone who follows Jesus, but I also wanted to encourage people to think more deeply about suffering and compassion.
Yeah, no, and we'll get more into suffering and compassion, of course, as we continue talking. And just, yeah, as an aside, like, I do want to say Montreal is, I think, maybe the only actually place, this is a little sad, but maybe the only place in Canada that I've actually been to, which is, again, is sad because I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, but I can attest like to the lovability of Montreal, at least because it's, you know, I spent a week there for an academic conference and it was really, really wonderful place. And I spent some time at McGill and there was this really great used bookstore right on the edge of the campus. The Word bookstore or Word bookstore,
right.
Something like that. Anyone who goes to Montreal should go to that bookstore. I also had the best ramen I've ever had in my life in Chinatown in Montreal.
Well, they've got a lot of good food there.
Yes,
and you're from Portland, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so I've been to Portland only once, but I enjoyed Powell's bookstore there.
Yes. Yeah, no, Powell's is great. Did you go to the downtown one?
I did.
Okay. I mean, it's just absolutely enormous. You almost like can't even browse there. You kind of have to know what you're looking for because it's literally a whole city block. But yeah, it's a really, really great bookstore.
You can spend days in there and not get through it all.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Before we get more into your book, let's start with our icebreaker question. So if you could place three figures in a room, they can be dead or alive, all together, and you could kind of listen into their conversation and be a fly on the wall, who would you choose to be in that room and why?
So I was thinking about this question and it's actually a hard question for me to answer. But one reason is because there are just so many people I'd like to hear talking. And sometimes that changes day to day. So like one day I might want to hear Bonhoeffer talking to someone, or another day I want to hear, you know, an actor talk to someone. And then there were plenty of people that I think I would want to read or watch or listen to for an hour or two. But I have a feeling I wouldn't enjoy their company. Like, the Apostle Paul really fascinates me, but I'm pretty sure we wouldn't have personalities that really, you know.
He's a little rough around the edges.
Yeah. if I were to consider some of the figures I bring out in my book, I think the most obvious response would be to hear from Jesus and Job. And if you'll let me have that little bit of leeway, because mm-hmm. I don't believe Job ever really existed. We have this lovely tradition of Job being a figure in several different ancient sources. So thinking of him as the character in the story of Job or the book of Job, speaking with Jesus, what I'd like to hear from them are reflections on how it felt to suffer without sensing God's presence. I compare that a little bit in my book, but I can imagine an extended dialogue between the two of them would be very interesting to listen to. And if I could just, as I'm thinking through this now, if I could just change the question a little bit, I'd like to have more leisurely dinners with my husband and family, my kids, when we're not rushing in from school and work and rushing out to evening activities. It's a little bit different than hearing from notable people, but it's just the one time of the day when we can get together and have meaningful family conversations. And I think relationships are important, and we get busy doing things instead of enjoying one another's company. So that's maybe the most authentic answer to your question that I can give you.
Yeah, no, I like that answer a lot. It's a unique answer, but it's totally true. Like, I have a 3.5-year-old daughter, and it's, you know, breakfast, it's always a rush to get her off to, you know, to preschool, and then at dinner, it's like we're all trying to get done with work as early as we can, and then get, you know, dinner cooked and have everybody eat before bedtime. So, you know, a nice, you know, just unrushed dinner or any kind of meal really with family would, I agree, would be really, really delightful. Okay, so in the introduction to your book, Suffering Well, Suffering With, you describe your own experience of severe suffering as feeling sort of like an alienation from your body, is how you describe it. And you also talk about kind of some of the changes that your own body went through during your treatment for cancer. So could you say a little bit more about kind of how you experienced those changes, as well as how those physical changes you went through may have made you kind of feel estranged from your body, like you talk about in the book?
Yeah. So let me set the scene. So my husband, Phil, and I had just moved back to Winnipeg. He had accepted a position as a minister of a United Church congregation here. And I was shortly thereafter offered my job at the Ethics Center. He was 31, I was 32. The reverse. I was 31, he was 32. And it's funny how you get those things mixed up. Just like I get the names of my kids mixed up sometimes. I was about 3 months into my work there when, with no warning, I suffered a focal seizure. So the symptoms began with blurred vision. I had trouble. I was looking at my computer screen and I had trouble reading the words and then the letters even. They looked mixed up. And then I had trouble interpreting what I was reading. It was a very strange experience. Then the right side of my face and my right arm became numb. And all of this crescendoed into nausea. So shortly thereafter, I had a CT scan, which revealed a mass in my brain about the size of a lemon. And that's when everything had changed, everything. That everything began with my body and what I would learn to be the tumor growing inside my brain. So I had experienced headaches for a while, but I really hadn't thought anything of it. Lots of people have headaches. And, you know, I had two tiny kids to look after. My older one was 2 years old and my younger one was 8 months old. So for about 3 years, I had paid a lot of attention to my body. I needed to make sure my body was healthy enough, well enough to birth and care for two little kids. So I breastfed both of them. I was just weaning my younger one. I had taken great care to eat the right foods. I had lots of exercise because my kids, you know, just gave me chase. It was just there's no way to not have exercise. So I felt like I was taking care of my body. So all of this came out of the blue, and I had to reconcile what was happening in my body with who I thought I was. I've heard many people say things like, my body betrayed me, right? When I read all this literature on people suffering from cancer, they tend to use that phrase, my body betrayed me. And I think it makes a lot of sense when it comes to cancer, because cancer is that kind of condition that begins in your body with the replication and growth of your own body cells. It's a normal process turned abnormal. But when I read that phrase, I couldn't relate to it. It didn't feel like my body betrayed me. I felt like for some reason I betrayed my body. Like I hadn't paid enough attention to my headaches. I should have been on this sooner. And logically I knew it wasn't true that I hadn't paid enough attention to my body. Even if I had flagged my headaches and went to the doctor to get them checked out, there was no way I could have spotted cancer early enough to treat it before it became malignant. So it's one thing to know something logically and another thing to feel something very different. And so this was perhaps the first time in my suffering that I had a real bump up between my emotional and existential feelings against what I knew in my mind. And that was a really interesting thing to go through. Interesting in hindsight, not at the time. It was it was terrifying to go through. I remember thinking how ironic it was that the cancer was in my brain. And I thought immediately, my thoughts went to things that other cancer patients would find offensive. I wished that I had something like breast cancer instead of brain cancer. My biggest asset, I thought, was my mind, right? That's what my bread and butter comes from. And now I worried it would be taken away from me. And there were other bodily sufferings I went through as I went through treatment. There's a story in the book about a pre-op experience that I think is the greatest and gravest encounter I've ever had with physical suffering. But, you know, even after the surgery, after I was diagnosed, my subsequent treatment caused me suffering. So I had 6 weeks of daily radiation therapy. And then there was a little break of about 4 weeks before I started six-week cycles of three very taxing chemo drugs. I took the last drug about 14 months into treatment, and then I had a recovery period of a few more months. Now, I still have some minor side effects that remain with me in my body. I'm very tender in certain places. I get some cramping in my legs and feet and toes. It is getting a little bit better with time. But all of this is to say that treatment put me in a position of suffering for a long time. And that time gave me opportunity to explore the questions that were crowding my mind. Questions like, how long do I have to live? Questions like, why has everything been taken away from me? You know, I felt like I was at sort of the right place. I had been a newly minted Christian ethicist. I was a wife, a mother, and now I felt like somehow I had betrayed not only my body, but also, you know, my colleagues, my husband, my children, worried that they would grow up without a mother. So for me, that's what my bodily suffering did to me as a whole person. It really disassembled my life for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. How about socially? How did it affect you? Now you're describing already sort of how it might have affected your relationships with your family and your colleagues. But, you know, just more generally speaking, did your experience as, a social being, a social person, did that change in any way during your treatment, would you say? Like, did others sort of treat you differently? And if they did, you know, how so? And did that shape your sense of self in any significant ways during this time?
Yes. But I think that's to be expected. The times I felt most socially excluded was when I was out in public. And not out in public with people I know, or certainly not feeling exclusion from the people I know, but out in public with strangers. And I can think of a time right after leaving the hospital from after having surgery. I left with a partially shaved head and a line of staples covering a black wound that ran through it. My face was red and swollen to the extent that my eyes could barely open. And, you know, even on that few minutes walk from the hospital to the parking lot, I felt like everyone around me saw me as unclean, that kind of biblical sense of unclean, untouchable, undesirable, hard to look at. I felt like a disgrace, a social disgrace. And that was a really hard thing to go through over a few minutes. But at that time, it's funny how all these different thoughts come into your head at the same time. At the same time, I remember thinking, there are many people who face this every day, right? There are many people who look hideous all the time. And my thoughts went to an individual I had seen several times on the Montreal Metro, someone who had a serious facial deformity. Her appearance had always caused me to avert my eyes. And I thought I was being polite, like not drawing attention to her by not gawking at her. But I really don't think if I self-examine, I don't think that was the real problem. The real problem was, first, I was repulsed by her. No question. And second, I don't think I would have known how to address her if I had wanted to. I don't think I would have known how to do that properly. And I wondered if she ever got used to feeling that way. So that was how I felt in public. And I would continue to feel that way when I lost my hair a couple of times. You have to get used to things like that. It happens. The time spent in suffering, in treatment in particular, means that you in a way get used to it, but it never feels good. I can't say I was ever shown that kind of, oh, you look awful stare or even in words by my family. I'm very grateful my family never said or did anything like that. I knew that they could be polite enough to conceal any of their aversion. But the first big test about how my family would regard me came from my older child, my two-year-old. And it was, again, like coming from the hospital. My kids hadn't seen me yet. It had been several days since the surgery. So they'd been staying with my in-laws at the time. And I was really distracted with worry about how I would be received by them. I rationalized that my 8-month-old, 9-month-old would not really be repulsed by my experience, by my appearance, because they were too young to really get it. But I was worried that my 2-year-old would be very capable of offering a frank and undisguised response. I was worried that he wouldn't even recognize me. I had only seen my face in a mirror once in the hospital, and I didn't recognize me. So I was worried that he'd be scared by the monster at the door. And when I stepped through the threshold of the house, I heard the pounding of little feet rushing toward me. And I looked up the few steps to the landing. And at the top was my son. He had this big, broad, bright smile. And he said, "Mummy." And he wrapped his arms around my neck and wouldn't let go. And nothing else mattered in that moment except that I was his mom and he was my son. And it was just such uncomplicated, unfettered love that you rarely feel, rarely experience.
Yeah, man, that's so beautiful. Okay. And then, in terms of, others who were not strangers, family, friends, mm-hmm. others who you were, actually interacting with perhaps, and not just folks you're walking past or, sitting next mm-hmm. to on the metro or whatever. How did others sort of respond, not just to your new status in life, but specifically to your suffering, to watching, to witnessing you suffering? And how did some of these people maybe suffer well with you, mm-hmm. or perhaps not so well during this time of your treatment?
Well, I'll preface this by something that one of my oncologists had told me when I was in my first meeting with him. He said, because you're young and because you are healthy, treatment will be taxing for you, but it may not be very taxing in terms of your appearance. And he said that at times people are going to look at you when you park in the handicapped parking spot and say, "Is she really suffering from a handicap?" It was true. There were times like that when people looked at me twice and thought, "Yeah, she's not. She doesn't deserve that spot." But in terms of how people that knew me responded to me, so I really can't praise my family members enough. I received unending care from them, and so what I'd like to do is focus on church in particular. I was fortunate enough to have two church communities caring for me, both the church that my husband grew up in and the church under his ministry. So these two churches worked together to ensure that my family had meals from Monday to Friday every week I was in treatment. So for over a year, we had meals. And this was important. And I knew people thought it was important because it meant I wouldn't have to cook. But I'm not sure they knew the other matter that was really important to me. It meant I didn't have to smell a cooking meal. And as someone who went through so much nausea through treatment, that was a double blessing. I didn't have to smell food cooking when all I could take was water or a a smoothie or something like that. It was huge. We received free childcare from a neighbor. We had church members volunteer to drive me to and from medical appointments. Friends from other provinces visited us. We had people popping by just, you know, to give me someone to talk to bring me a smoothie, to give me a call, that kind of thing. I got mail. And who gets mail these days? It was also really important for me to control my story, to control what people learned. And maybe this is a surprise because I use so much of my story in my book. I'm quite a private person. Mm-hmm. So throughout my treatment, I sent out weekly email updates, first to my friends and family. And by the end of treatment, there were hundreds of people on that list. And some of them were people I knew well. Some of them were people I had never met. Some who were Christians, some who were members of another faith, some who didn't have a faith at all. And for me, it was that love and compassion that I received from the people who wrote back to me, who said, "I'm so glad that you're going, that your week's been better," or "I'm so sorry that your week's been worse. We're thinking of you, praying for you." And there's something to that, right? It really cuts through some of the isolation of suffering. And it was at a time when I felt like I was, and we can talk about this more later, but it was a time when I felt isolated from God too. And so it was really helpful for me to just have these people say, you know, we want to be there for you, and we're thinking of you and praying for you, even if we're not living in the same country. Hmm. But of course, no one gets perfect care. So maybe I'll talk a little bit about that too. So one of the reasons I wrote the book was because as church communities, we don't always know how to respond well to suffering people. We can get uncomfortable. I think for many of us, we want to pay attention to people's suffering. We want to intervene, especially when questions are brought up about God and God's involvement in the suffering. I was no exception to receiving people's sentiments that tried to explain away my suffering, using those verses like, "All things will work together for good." Well, maybe that works well for some people, but it didn't work well for me. It made me feel estranged. I felt like they were not really looking at my suffering very seriously. I felt like they were holding my suffering at arm's length. And that meant they were also holding me at arm's length, because for a time I felt like I was nothing but suffering, and I felt like they didn't understand that. So one example is of the time I went to church on the first occasion after my surgery. It had been a few weeks, and the first song that was sung was about trading personal sorrow for God's joy. I don't know if you know this song. It felt like a stab in the back to me. And I don't think that was intentional. I'm sure it wasn't intentional. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the worship leaders weren't thinking, "Oh, Amy's coming to church today. Let's sing her a happy song about getting rid of suffering." And I know that the words of the song are derived from scripture, but the way they're put to music and the way they're sung, it's just so glib, and it really didn't stand up to experience. This song, I felt like it was outright dismissing profound, innocent suffering. You know, there was no way I could trade what I was going through for joy. And if there had been a way, I would have found it by now. It made no sense to me, and I felt dismissed. And this is also an example of how we spend more time in church community praising and thanking God unquestioningly than we do questioning God when we don't understand what's going on around us or within us. What suffering people need is a community that says to them, "I can't explain your suffering. I can see that you're walking through that valley of the shadow of death, and I know it's a long walk. And if you let me, I'll walk it with you." So that really brought me to think about lament. And there's a chapter in my book about lament. In the early days of treatment, I was on a steroid that disturbed my sleep-wake cycle. So I was often waking up at 3 or 4 in the morning and going to bed at 3 or 4 in the afternoon. So my husband started to get up early with me, and together we went through scripture and just really frank prayers. And that's how we learned to lament. We looked at the story of Job. We looked at Lamentations. We looked at the Psalms of Lament, trying to make sense of what we were going through. Particularly the Psalms were important for me. And as I started to look at these more in a studious way, I went to my favorite Old Testament scholar, Walter Brueggemann, to think about the Psalms, particularly the Lament Psalms. And so I got a sort of typology of the Psalms from Brueggemann, and that's that there are three types of Psalms. Psalms of orientation, which reflect well-being and praise to God. You know, all is right with the world. There are Psalms of disorientation, which reflect suffering, despair, lament. And then there are Psalms of new orientation. And they're not exactly a replication of orientation. They're a little bit different. They reflect a new divine joy that's broken into suffering. So the person voicing a psalm of new orientation understands that life is not all about being well because we're healthy and we have everything we need. They reflect an understanding that sometimes suffering is unavoidable and that we need to learn how to be well while we suffer. And each types of these psalms are voiced either by individuals or communities. And so in that way, they'd be appropriate for the church. But we focused, of course, on the Psalms of disorientation. And what I really liked about these psalms was that the people praying them, the people singing them, were telling God in no uncertain terms what they were going through. And they were telling God in no uncertain terms that God needed to address this. And I really found that refreshing, because I was never taught it's okay to tell God, you know, to do something. We can pray to God for things. We can ask God to do something. But it's never okay to make demands of God. And these psalms were making demands of God. I really think that they also show us that God is open to receiving that kind of thing. And we see this not only because the Psalms of Lament reflect the generations of suffering that people have gone through talking to God over and over and over, but we also see God's action and response in the story of Job. At the end of the story, after all three of Job's friends and another person tell Job, you know, what they think his suffering is about, and after Job, you know, goes through various accounts of defending God and praying to God, God shows up in this whirlwind and God tells Job what's what. But then God tells Job's friends that Job was right all along. They say, God says to them that they've been unjust and uncaring, and only Job is worthy of being called God's servant. And the reason for this that I see in the text is that the friends have only spoken about God. Job, on the other hand, spoke to God. Even though God, out of the whirlwind, responded to Job by saying, sort of, who do you think you are? I'm going to show you the kind of power I have and the lack of power that you have. God took what Job had said to him and interpreted it as being faithful. So the friends had only spoken about God, their own ideas about what God's role is in all of this. But Job spoke to God. So in reading this, I've come to see that God would rather hear our angry accusations, as long as we're being earnest, than just the empty applause, the empty, you know, praise in a worship service that doesn't have a whole lot of thought behind it. So I knew that even if I felt God was absent, I could claim that, like Job, my prayers, my laments wouldn't be made in vain. One more thing about lament, if you'll allow me.
Yeah.
So 40% of those psalms, those three categories of psalms, 40% of them are psalms of disorientation. And that to me is really significant, since 40% of our worship does not reflect that, right? We don't look at them very often, whether it's in worship or whether it's in a Bible study or another kind of community gathering. And on the rare occasion they are used, they serve as kind of a preface. You know, too quickly, we want to be delivered to new orientation. Too quickly, we want to be delivered from Good Friday to Easter Sunday. You know, I don't think that Mary and the other women mourning the death of Jesus knew that Easter Sunday was coming around the bend, but we're often told not to worry. You know, it's sad today on Good Friday, but Sunday's coming around the corner. That's really dismissive of suffering. So I think it's important for the church to spend more time in lament. I think if we do that, we can better learn how to talk to God. We can better learn how to be honest with God. And I think we would also learn the words to say when we sit with someone who is so deep in suffering that they are struggling to find words to say. I really think lament is key if we want to reinvigorate compassion in our church communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I like that a lot. That, like, this idea of, you know, the need for us as Christian communities to kind of build a grammar of suffering. Because I do think that's, you know, you talked about, people responding, you know, in ways that were not helpful to you. I just think people have such a fear, you know, of not knowing what to say or of saying the wrong thing, right? And there's sort of this choice of, you know, to what extent you're going to allow someone else's suffering to affect you and to sort of enter into it with them, right? And that's that can be really uncomfortable. But I think a huge part of it, like as you're saying, is, you know, so much time we just don't know what to say to people, right? So I really like this idea of, like, yeah, like I said, building kind of a vocabulary, developing a way to talk about it so that we're able to, not to like have things to say or something, or to like be able to, you know, offer them some, you know, great wisdom, but just to be able to sit with them and to be able to have conversations and to listen in ways that might actually be meaningful to people who are suffering.
Sometimes it's about listening and not saying a whole lot.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, I want to turn to evil, because you do talk about the relationship between suffering and evil in your book. You talk about it a good bit, actually. So what in your mind is the kind of the relationship between these two realities? What do they have to do with each other?
Yeah. So maybe I'll start with some definitions. So in my definition for suffering in the book, I first borrow from Eric Cassell, who's one of the founders of bioethics. And Eric Cassell says that suffering is a distressed response to the loss or to the destruction of something of great importance, perhaps even utmost importance. What I find interesting about that definition is that suffering isn't the loss of that important thing. Suffering is our response to that loss. It's something that happens within a person. And that's one reason, not the only reason, but it's one reason why two people can suffer the same loss and respond very differently to it. But I also think that inner distress we feel when we come up against loss or destruction is often isolating. So distress and isolation, I think, are paired here when it comes to suffering. And that's really where I start in my book, understanding the kind of way I want to approach suffering. Now, when it comes to evil, I do think of suffering as a form of evil. I tend to narrow a sort of approach to evil or a definition of evil, narrow it down to being anything that is the opposite of God. So if we understand that God is good, then anything that's not good is evil. Another way to put this might be that evil is anything that separates us from God. So if in the experience of suffering, if we experience isolation from God, if we experience separation from God, then suffering can be said to be evil. I consider separation from God itself not just our experience of it, but if we are in reality separated from God, I consider that to be the ultimate form of evil. It's the idea of Sheol, and certainly in the Old Testament scriptures. But to continue with evil for a moment, more generally, there's more than one variety or maybe type of evil. So one kind of evil is moral evil, and another kind of evil is natural evil. So these are kinds of classifications of evil that are quite broad, I think, in Christian ethics. So moral evil being the evil found in what we do, the bad things or the wrong things that we do. So if we consider the kind of symbolic meaning of suffering in the Genesis story of the fall, there's this result that comes from turning away from God, right? Not just the sin of doing something that God wants us to not do, but the turning away from God, the result of moral evil. And that is the beginning of isolation for Adam and Eve, these characters. We also see Adam and Eve isolating themselves from each other, right? The two of them cover their bodies, shielding themselves, and they hide from God. They isolate themselves from their creator. So why do they do this? As I think of it, as I read it, they're afraid of each other. They don't know if they can trust each other. And they're also afraid of God. They don't know how God will respond to them. And fear is another form of suffering. And fear can certainly be evil if it separates you from God. Now, of course, there's other experience of suffering that aren't caused by immoral acts. And in large part, the focus of my book is on suffering that is not evil, that is caused by something that is immoral. I focus instead on innocent suffering, on suffering that comes out of nowhere. No one has any blame in terms of this suffering. No one's caused it. So sometimes this is called natural evil. Natural evil is also the place where the rubber meets the road when it comes to questions of theodicy. If there's no one to blame for this suffering, then, well, what's God's role in this, right? There's obviously no punishment happening here, as there might have been with Adam and Eve. So these questions of theodicy really come to a head, right? Why does such a loving and powerful God allow for evil and suffering in the world? And maybe even more pointedly, why does God allow faithful followers to be subject to evil? So the evil of suffering is both this idea of distress and isolation, and it can really upend our lives, especially if it's a profound loss, if it's one of the most profound losses you can experience. We often see people sort of in the shock of suffering, right? This sort of, I don't know what to do now. I don't know what to say. I don't know what's next. Our lives can be completely disoriented. And one of the most vexing things about the situation for our society is that we don't have the power to eradicate suffering fully without eradicating all the people who suffer, without eradicating a creation that suffers. We keep trying, but we haven't gotten there, and I don't think we ever will. And when we try to get there, I think we end up creating new problems that get in the way of eradicating suffering. And that's because only God has the power to do this. And so we can certainly see that separating ourselves from God can happen when we suffer. There are certainly people who will say, I don't believe in God anymore because why would God do this to me? But there are also times when it feels like it felt for Job, like it felt for me, that God had turned away from us. So when I was suffering, when I was going through this disorientation of my life, my whole life had been upended. I couldn't find God anymore. It was like God was absent, like I was forsaken, even though it was the time I needed God more than ever. The God I had known all my life, the God known for generations, was absent. I have yet to find an explanation of theodicy that accomplishes, first, a thorough, robust justification of God. Second, adequate meaning to suffering to try to justify its presence in the world. And third, and maybe most importantly, a theodicy that comforts people who are in profound, innocent suffering. It's that last part in particular, that idea of the theodicy needing to comfort people who are suffering, that is so important to me. There's, in my mind, very little value in a robust scholarly argument on theodicy if it fails to bring God and the suffering person back together. And really, it turned me off when I was reading theodicy. I was trying to figure this out. I knew that it's the question of the day, right? In both theology and ethics. Why does God allow suffering to happen? But every explanation for theodicy was turning me off. And I really liked the way that Eleanor Stump put it. We have no taste for the trade they offer, right? Suffering people have no taste for scholarly explanations of theodicy. And so that brings me back to lament. I think lament, both personal lament and lament done in community, is critical to suffering well, right? It helps us realize that we are ultimately contingent on God. It also reminds us, though, the reason why we're lamenting to God, that God has a habit of keeping covenant with creation. And I tend to think of God as a slow God. And that was one of the big realizations I had while I was suffering. A God that doesn't work by our clock, right? A God who doesn't bring us things just because we pray for them. And a God that doesn't seem to be distracted by the value of efficiency, something that I think we embrace quite broadly today. So if I can hope in that kind of God, a God who is faithful across generations, I can learn to suffer well. I can learn to avoid letting suffering overcome my whole life, my whole sense of self, my whole sense of self-worth, my relationships with others. And instead, I can turn toward a God in hope, even when I feel like God is absent. And it's because it's a long hope in a slow God.
Yeah, it makes me think a bit of Kosuke Koyama. I'm not sure if I'm saying his name exactly correctly. Yes. But yeah, I know he shows up in your book as well. I forgot about that. But yeah, no, it reminds me, yeah, very much of his ideas. You've maybe touched on this a bit already, but you might perhaps have more to say about sort of where the church stands today in its understanding of suffering. But also in sort of the task it has before itself of equipping Christians to suffer well on the one hand and to suffer with others well, as we've talked about. So especially what I want to ask is, where is there sort of room for improvement within the church on this front?
Yeah, so I think I need to speak both to how the church responds to suffering individuals and how the church needs to recognize the suffering it's going through right now. So I'll talk about suffering individuals and our response to that first. So my understanding of human beings is that we're created for community. We're not created to just, you know, be on our own island. We don't do very well on our own. We can look at scripture for evidence of that, but we can also look at our own lives for evidence of this. We need to regard other people as holding God-given value or dignity, and especially when the person we're regarding feels they have no dignity at all, right? No value at all. We need to be the kinds of people who are capable of showing them that they're worth suffering for. We also, as individuals, feel the need to have others regard us as someone with value or dignity, right? We engage with other people because we think we have something to bring, right? Not only that, though, I think that we have value and dignity because it's God-given, right? It's not dependent on how much we can bring to a relationship. It's not dependent on how much we contribute. It's also not dependent on how autonomous we are. But the idea here is that if it's God-given, it's something that is a part of our nature, and it doesn't depend on how well we are in our bodies. And we really need to feel the positive regard of other people when we're in that situation. One of the things that the church is called to be is a community that practices compassion, right? Suffering with. Community that suffers with suffering people because they are worth our suffering. It's not just the ability, though, to suffer with suffering people. It's also the readiness to do this. And I think that's where we really need to improve on in our communities. We, you know, I was certainly given lots of support by my two church communities. And I think there was a level of readiness when it came to the practical support, but less of a readiness to offer the spiritual support because they weren't ready to offer it. They certainly didn't have the kinds of learning or experience, most people, to offer this right away. So this is something I think we can work on. And of course, lament is part of that. We need to also accept as Christian bodies that disorientation is a legitimate human experience, right? That in the body of Christ, some people suffer innocently and profoundly, and we need to avoid sending messages that demean that suffering or dismiss it as either something that will bring great meaning to your life or something you should take your focus off of. You know, don't wallow in your suffering, that kind of thing. So the people who didn't tell me to move along quickly from disorientation to hope, but remained present as I grieved, as I lamented, and as I asked God where God was, those were the people who were ready to show me compassion. And we really need more people in our communities to do this, because we can't just have one or two people, right? We can't depend on the pastor of the church. We can't depend on a couple of people who are really compassionate people to do this. We have to claim this as a whole church community, because I do think it's a mark of Christian identity. And so then I think about the status of the church in our world today, particularly in a post-Christendom Western world. And I started thinking about this as early on as while I was in treatment, because we hadn't gone through COVID yet, but I could see a lot of the, you know, the violent responses when churches were questioned or when churches felt like their political rights or their social rights were being trampled on. And I think the reason this is happening is because we are in post-Christendom, right? We are... we've held power for so long, we've become accustomed to holding power. Mm. But now we're in a post-Christendom age and we're declining both in influence and in membership. And I certainly see this in Canada. I don't know how much you're seeing it in the United States, but in Canada, there's very little influence when it comes to church. So we as church are suffering, and I don't think that's going to change. But we also don't know what to do with that. We've had power for so long that we've forgotten how to suffer well, because for centuries we didn't think we needed to, right? We didn't think of suffering well as part of our identity. And so as I see it, we have maybe two options. And the first option I see happening a lot, we can try to strategize our way out of this. We can try to strategize our way back into some kind of power. It might be power in terms of getting more members, and maybe later on having more influence in society. I don't have a whole lot of great expectations around that. Mm-hmm. We can also, on the other hand, ask the question, is power really the calling of the church? Or are we meant to be a people who, when we are suffering, when we must suffer, a people who know how to suffer well, or to, and also to know how to suffer well with others by demonstrating compassion? The title of my book speaks it, right? I think that we need to reclaim the ability and the readiness to suffer well as church and also to suffer with others. This means that if we're being pushed to the margins of society, we need to suffer with other people who are already in the marginal space, right? Who have long inhabited the margins of society. And that's what I see from Jesus, right? The idea here is we find our allies, we find the people who are like us, that we've never recognized before as being like us, as the people we are called to suffer with, and also the people we are called to accept compassion from. There's this back and forth relationship that I think we can build if we recognize ourselves as not being, you know, the voice coming from the pulpit or the voice coming from a political party, but as maybe prophetic voices in the wilderness. We're on the margins, then we have a lot to learn from people who are already in the margins.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's really well said. I want to turn to the relationship between suffering and solidarity, because you have some really beautiful sections in your book about how suffering can actually be a source of solidarity or even a source of a kind of communion. Mm-hmm. So how would you describe this kind of bond that can take place between persons, this kind of communion that can take place through kind of a shared experience of suffering?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess that's what I've been talking about in terms of relating to people who have been in the margins for a long time. So in the book, I talk about the idea that suffering people hold something quite sacred in common. It's quite true that no one can suffer the way that I suffer, right? No one can feel exactly what I feel, when I'm feeling it, why I'm feeling it, and so on. And that itself is deeply isolating. However, there is a strange kind of solace, a very comforting thing when a suffering people sees other people suffering. And Albert Schweitzer calls it the fellowship of those who bear the mark of pain. It's a fellowship. And we don't often use that word outside church contexts, right? It's a fellowship. It's a community, a communion of those who bear the mark of pain. So when we're isolated from a world that appears to be well, we hold suffering in common. We're bonded together. I think that helps us recognize what Jesus is talking about in the Beatitudes when he says things like the blessed are the suffering, right? Blessed are the poor, blessed are the suffering. What on earth is Jesus talking about here? I think that Jesus is saying we're blessed not because suffering brings meaning to our lives, right? We're going to benefit from suffering. I think it's because suffering people have something staring us square in the face, something that others, you know, turn away from. And it's the truth that we are mortal, the truth that we're vulnerable, and that our lives are contingent upon something greater than us. I think of the great cloud of witnesses spoken of in Hebrews chapter 11. Suffering people today are included in this group of people who suffered innocently and did not receive what was promised, yet they remained hopeful in a greater promise. And I think this is a really important thought to hold on to. There are many ways suffering people can find themselves in this fellowship, right? Holding on to this bond with one another. For me, one example was joining a support group for people suffering with brain cancer, people who had a cause of suffering in common with me, even if they didn't respond to that cause in the same way. But this meant that within the group, there were people I was naturally drawn to, people who still remain my friends today. But to be honest, there were people I found it difficult to relate to. One person in this fellowship of suffering, this communion of suffering, also identified as Christian, and she spoke very little, and that was because she had suffered from her tumor. She had suffered from a loss of memory, and she had trouble bringing her thoughts to speech, and she continued to decline, throughout the year and a half I was in this group. But at the beginning of each meeting, there would be a check-in time. We would go around a circle and we would share how we were doing, you know, in not just in our bodies, but also how we were doing in our minds and our spirits. And during this check-in time, I could always count her to say this quite slowly, quite methodically. She would say, "Every day I wake up and I slowly put my feet on the floor. I stand up, I look out my window, and I say, this is the day that the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it." Now, the first time I heard this from her, I was nothing less than contemptuous. I'm really not a great person, am I? I think I was still in the shock of suffering, and she seemed to be regurgitating some kind of Christianized positive psychotherapy. Kind of like when my brain surgeon told me to imagine little Pac-Mans eating up the tumor ghosts in my brain. And like, I was very dismissive of that idea too. But I'm not proud to admit that I dismissed this woman at that point in time. But she kept saying this every meeting, same thing. This is the day that the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And it was slowly that I began to see that this was more than just a pattern that relied on a little nugget of experience that she remembered. I began to interpret it as a resilience that she had. She was actively resisting that distressed response to her loss, to the growing losses that she was experiencing. Every day, she was grateful for the day. Every day, joy was the first thought on her mind. Now, I don't know if she ever lamented, but if she did, she must have done so really humbly, recognizing that her time was different from God's time. And hearing this over and over and over again, I think she wore me down. I didn't ever develop that habit. I still don't wake up every day and just thank God for the day. I'm not like her in that way. But I started to think, okay, there's something to this. It's not just a meaningless sort of thanks God. It's filled with meaning for her. And not because her suffering is getting any better. So I think she was really one of those people in this great cloud of witnesses who spoke something more important to me than anyone could have told me about my biological health at the time. Mm-hmm. And I would say that was a huge example of a bond of suffering between people who are not very much alike.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I want to also talk about which with that example, you know, that might have been a good image of the very thing I want to talk about, which is actually the role of emotions in compassion. So I want to kind of zoom in my last couple of questions to pretty practical terrain of compassion, of what it means to suffer well with others. Mm-hmm. And my first question would be, you know, what is sort of the role of the emotions in compassion? And then also, like, is it possible to show compassion for others when we do not feel compassion for them? Mm-hmm. Maybe we just have personalities that, you know, are in friction, or we think that they're being a hypochondriac or you know, whatever the case may be, just when we're sort of waiting for the emotion to strike before we can show compassion. I wonder what you would say about that.
Yeah, I think that's a really important question and really important because, again, if we're going to claim something like compassion as a mark of our identity as Christians, then we can't let emotion control that. So I think of compassion as a virtue, right? And I guess this is the ethics lesson of the day. Virtues are reflected in both what we think of in terms of our attitude that we have, but also in the actions that we take. And the more we act well, more we act virtuously, the better of a character we become, right? The more virtuous character we develop, and it goes the other way too. The more virtuous we become in terms of our character, the more virtuous things we do, the more we act well and in good ways. And that's what compassion depends on, is a kind of discipline, right? Both to work on compassion in our hearts, our minds, our spirits, but also to act in compassionate ways. And that, I think, can't be dependent on emotion. And I'll give you a really important reason that I've discovered as I've looked at this. A lot of people, I think, liken compassion to empathy. This idea of feeling for another person, you know, even wanting to take someone's suffering on themselves. But I have to say that they're two different things. And one reason, of course, is that if we always wanted to take on other people's suffering, if we were always empathetic toward every suffering person, we would be exhausted. we can see this certainly in nursing practice, right? If you're always taking on the suffering of the patients that you're serving, you're going to get burnt out very quickly. So compassion is something different. Maybe another way I can differentiate is by sharing a story that I do mention in the book, but I use in the classroom a lot. It's about why empathy is inadequate to support compassion. So I don't know if you remember the Syrian refugee crisis that happened. I mean, it's still happening, but in 2015 in particular, there was a refugee crisis that came to a head. And in September of that year, there were a number of refugees trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea in a dinghy to reach Europe. And so one of the focuses, one of the reasons why this got into the news media is because along with their mother, two children drowned when their dinghy capsized shortly after leaving land. So these kids were two boys, Alan and Galip Kurdi. Alan was three, Galip was five. And some photos were taken of them on the Turkish beach where their bodies were washed up. You may have seen these photos. Maybe if I describe them, maybe you'll remember them. But Alan was lying on his belly. His face was half buried in the sand. He was dressed in a red top, blue shorts and sandals. And the way he was lying, it looked like he was napping. And perhaps the reason I remember this photo so well is that he was about the same age as my younger child at the time. He could have been my child. So that really hits you hard. Mm-hmm. Now, At the time, I may have learned he had a brother, but I don't remember seeing any photos of Galip. They do exist, and they were used in the earliest reports of the tragedy, but then they were taken out of news media. And it was Alan's pictures instead that came to be symbolic of this refugee crisis and came to prompt citizens across nations to call on their governments to take in more refugees. So the question is why were the photos of Alan widely used and why were Galip's not widely used? So I found a study that made observations of the differences between the photos of Alan and Gurdip. And one of them was a difference in age, right? Galip was a couple of years older. Perhaps Alan looked more innocent because he was only three. Another is the difference in the way their bodies were positioned. Alan was face down in the sand and Galip was face up. So his whole belly, chest, face were all very exposed, fully exposed. And this might have been, I guess, a perceived loss of dignity. It's not a dignified position to be in. There was also a difference in the camera lighting, the lighting that the cameras I guess that maybe the flash put on these two children. The colors in Galip's photos were cold and bluish. The colors in Alan's were much brighter. It made you feel, just in terms of how it reflected off of Alan's skin, it made you feel like maybe he was even alive, that he might wake up from his nap. Alan's skin color, hair color, were a little lighter than Galip's. He looked whiter than his brother. And finally, the final thing that is considered in this study is that because Alan's face and body were not very exposed, so much was left to the viewer's imagination. And as I said at the beginning, viewers in the white West could perceive this as any child, even our own child. So if these differences impacted the choice to feature photos of Alan rather than Gurdip or rather than both of them, I think this is an example of empathy that is conditional. The study itself says that there's a gap that divides privileged onlookers from suffering people who are far away from us, especially people with whom we have little in common. And we feel more empathy for those who look like us. So this leads me to question the value of empathy when it comes to compassion. Certainly, empathy can lead us to act with compassion. But empathy is neither the same thing as compassion, nor should it be the sole purpose for compassion. Empathy is conditional in a way that compassion is not. So compassion has to be the mark of character for both Christian individuals and the church. We have to have this attitude and live it out in order to be identified this way. Importantly, I think in our society, we misunderstand what compassion is. I think we do tend to identify it, as I said earlier, with empathy, but also with a dismissive kind of pity that says, oh, gee, I would never want to be in that condition, right? I would never want to have to be that parent, or I would never want to have to go through the cancer you're going through. It communicates to suffering people that you what you're going through is not worth going through. And so it also fits hand in glove with this idea that I think our society, and it reflects, I think, in medical systems as well, our society is made to be efficient. Our society is made to care for people who can get well. And people who can't get well receive less funding in healthcare and less funding in social services. And so I really think this is a place, this place of compassion where we suffer well with people. That's where we need to be as church when the rest of our society is doing very little for people who can't get well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I remember a part in your book where you talk about, I don't know if you use exactly this language, but there's almost sort of a clock ticking as far as kind of our tolerance for standing alongside someone who's suffering. Yeah. and that when their experience of suffering doesn't follow our sense of time that we think it should, that it's very hard for us to sort of stay with them in that place and not to want to push them out of it. What does it look like, would you say, to listen well when another person is sharing their suffering with us on the one hand, and then also, like, what are some of the pitfalls you think that we tend to fall into when we're trying to support people who are suffering?
Mm, yeah. If I speak to that second question first, I think it's really easy for people in ministry leadership to fall into those pitfalls because often the work is given to them. We need to, I've said this earlier, we need to have communities do this work together. We need to have communities ready to collaborate in compassion because it is a burden. And I know we don't like to say that, but it is a burden to care for people who are suffering. And we need to admit that. But it's also a burden that is worth suffering. And so if we're convicted that this is a burden worth suffering, we need to share in that suffering together. That's the only way we can do this. We are currently experiencing exhaustion, not only within healthcare systems, I know it's happening in the US as well as Canada, but we're also experiencing exhaustion when it comes to things like support care at home or end-of-life care in hospices and that kind of location. And we need to do this as community because we certainly can't do this as individuals on our own. Your first question was about listening well. Mm-hmm. So listening well is something I open every class I teach. We talk about what it is to listen well to one another. In the book, I highlight a few stories about how Jesus listens well to people when he's called to heal them. And I think what's interesting about that is that it's not only the healing, but also the listening well that makes it possible for people who have been considered unclean and marginalized to be restored to their communities. But of course, it's not easy to listen to suffering people because they're in a state of chaos. And we're not used to chaos. We like to impose order on our lives. We have to get to work at a certain time. We have to drop our kids off at school at a certain time. We have to make supper at a certain time. These things are all ordered. And chaos troubles that order. It troubles the structures that guide our lives. Skillful listening, though, resists those structures. It makes time for disorder. And it means not running too quickly to label suffering as some kind of meaning. Bonhoeffer says that listening well is the most loving thing we can do. Listening well is the most loving thing we can do. And again, it helps people who are suffering feel like they are worth suffering for. feel like there is some kind of meaning in their life that other people are recognizing, some kind of value in their life that other people are recognizing, and that is really transformative for a person. The other thing Bonhoeffer talks about in terms of how to listen well, it is providing presence. It is, if we are responding to a person who is speaking, providing intelligent responses, but not so much teaching responses, but responses that bring out further thoughts from the person we're listening to. So asking questions like, you know, I hear you saying this, I wonder if you could say more about that. I wonder if you could explain that a little more. There are other ways that other maybe temptations that we face or habits that we have that we need to get rid of. And one of them is mine, I admit, and that's listening with half an ear. This is when I hear someone saying something and I think I know what they're saying before they finished saying it. And while they're still speaking, I am coming up with something to respond to them with, right? I'm coming up with my own response. And so I'm not paying them full attention. I'm listening with half an ear. And this is actually what Bonhoeffer calls self-absorbed condescension. And so this is something that I need to work on myself, especially as someone who's an educator, right? You don't want to have ready-made responses to people who are learning, and particularly in my field, how to live an ethical life. You need to really listen to where they're coming from, because if we don't understand where they're coming from, what we can offer is not always applicable. It puts us in a position, I think, where we are exerting power in the conversation, that we're more knowledgeable than the other person that we're listening to. And that's just a turnoff for people who are suffering.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, as we close, I want to just give you a chance to share a little bit more about your work, maybe what's kind of next for you in your work, or anything you might like to plug, as well as just give you a chance to share where our listeners can find you if they want to learn more about you and your work.
Yeah. So, in consideration of compassion, one of the the weighty things that we have going on in Canada and in certain provinces, certain states rather, in the U.S., you have going on is physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. So in Canada, we call it medical assistance in dying or MAID. And I think Canada is a bellwether for any nation engaged in these acts in medical systems, because in Canada, medical assistance in dying is already accessible for persons whose sole cause of suffering is disability. And in March, MAID will be accessible to persons whose sole cause of suffering is mental illness. And I really think this is, it fits well with that idea of efficiency, right? This idea that mirrors the broader Western culture, that patients who can get better faster are favored over those who can't, that people who will thrive are the people who can pull up their bootstraps and support themselves. So there's very low funding for patients declining at the end of life, including long-term care supports, including hospice palliative care. And in society, it's reflected by low funding supplied to people who bear multiple causes of suffering, including poverty. And so we're starting to see medical assistance in dying being offered to persons who may technically meet the criteria for its provision, but are choosing to hasten their deaths because they have inadequate care or nowhere to live. Mm. And these are problems that anyone with compassion wants to respond to. And that's just not happening. Instead, they're being offered death. And I just think that's deplorable. And I think the only voice we have right now is the voice of the church that can say, we disagree with this provision for many reasons, but right now no one is filling that gap for people who are on the margins. And that's where the church needs to be. So that's my next project. I've started the research for that. I haven't, you know, submitted any chapters to anybody, but that's sort of okay. Where I am in the next project. And you wanted to know where listeners can find me? Well, my work address is amy.patterson@salvationarmy.ca. And I should probably spell my name, AIMEEPATTERSON. Amy.Patterson@salvationarmy.ca. They can also see my blog, amypatterson.com, and I'm on Twitter at Amy E. Patterson. So that's three E's, Amy, A-I-M-E-E-E, Patterson.
We'll leave links in the show notes as well. So
great.
That'll make
be
it really easy for people to access. No, I want to say thank you very much, Amy, for taking the time today. Yeah, really valued our conversation. I thought it was a really lovely time. So appreciate it very much.
I appreciate it too. It's been great.